Welcome again to the Milt Rosenberg podcast. And again, it is not a matter of accident that this is Milt Rosenberg. But I trust you won't hear too much of me today because I want to hear a great deal from my two guests, both of whom are treasured old friends, and both of whom are from the group that we used to call the A-Team at our program at WGN. In fact, we're doing this program from the WGN studios. And the two guests today are Joe Morris, who has not yet graced this podcast series, but was a very frequent guest at Extension 720, and Christopher Roebling, who has been here often in podcast incarnation. I'm going to do something unusual. We're talking today about the Middle East issues and how they affect American progress and politics and our own president's role in all of that. But basically, our concerns are with what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in the Levant, and especially between Israel and the Palestinians. But gentlemen, first, rather than my giving wordy introductions, here's a challenge for you. I want each of you to introduce the other. Chris Roebling, what is there to be said about our good friend Joe Morris?
Former Assistant Attorney General of the United States for International Relations and longtime contributor to the civic discourse of not just the Chicago region, but indeed that of the state of Illinois, the country and the world, through his many travels overseas, I welcome my longtime friend, Joe Morris.
One might add, and a partner in the international law firm of Morris and De La Rosa.
Absolutely.
And Joe Morris, what is there to be properly said about Chris Roebling?
A man of exceptionally many parts, including an early history as an employee of the Central Intelligence Agency, an alumnus of Georgetown University, someone who was lost to the Senior Intelligence Service and the Foreign Service because he wanted to come home and do politics and civic engagement here in Chicago. So our gain, the nation's loss. Chris has served as, among other things, a member of the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners and a real-life working journalist. He was a news anchor on an all-news radio station that broadcasts from less than a block away from where we sit. He is currently the senior principal of a major local media and communications consulting firm. And I suppose in the interests of full disclosure, I should note that he has in the past been a client of the firm called Morris and De La Rosa.
One thing that might be added, as a matter of fact, concerning you, since you just made mention of Chris's membership in the past on the Chicago Board of Elections, is that you could be considered the man, or should I say could be accused to be the man, who made the current mayor of Chicago mayor of Chicago.
Well, that accusation has been thrown against me as recently as just a few minutes ago when your producer, Brian Jones, Mr. Roebling and I were ascending in the elevator to this studio, and we encountered a well-known Chicago journalist at the Chicago Tribune next door, the co-tenant or the owner of the building, John Cass, who greeted me in the elevator, threw his wides open and said, "It's all your fault." He was referring, of course, to, as I think you are, to my service as the administrative judge for the Chicago Board of Election Commissioners, the hearing officer to whom was assigned the 30 or 40 odd cases involving challenges to the ballot access of the man who became our mayor, Rahm Emanuel. I presided over that case.
And ruled that he was a legitimate citizen of Chicago.
I ruled him a legitimate resident of the city of Chicago and ordered him on the ballot. And after I was the low man on the totem pole, but after an appeal that went all the way up to the Supreme Court of our sovereign state, the Supreme Court agreed with me and ordered him on the ballot.
Now then, let us come to the matters of the day or of the week. Indeed, I might say the matter of the week. About a week ago, there was considerable concern that the group that is conventionally now called ISIS or ISIL, Islamic State of Iraq and Lebanon, or Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant.
Al-Shams, yeah. The S is from the Arabic way of saying the Levant.
Yes. And it has, well, Dianne Feinstein said it a week ago. Listen to a news item from April 8. The head of the Senate Intelligence Committee on Friday said the extremist group, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS or ISIL, must be confronted forcefully by the U.S., though she stopped short of calling for boots on the ground. It takes an army to defeat an army, and I believe that we either confront ISIL now or we will be forced to deal with an even stronger enemy in the future, Senator Dianne Feinstein said in a statement. The group is operating with military expertise, advancing across Iraq, and rapidly consolidating its position. Inaction is no longer an option, according to Feinstein. The senior lawmaker also said it had, quote, become clear that the group is recruiting and training fighters from Western countries and possibly sending them back to cities in the U.S. and Europe in order to, quote, attack us in our backyard. We simply cannot allow this to happen. And we must, with that also, quickly recall that the news coverage as of about a week ago, and by the way, we are recording on the date of August 15, that about a week ago, the news focus was on the fact that these guys were, quote, beheading their way to Baghdad, and that the Islamic State might very well take over both what is now Syria and what is Iraq. And we were told, essentially, that their intent was to establish Islamic rule the world over. And their leader, their putative leader, made statements to that effect and reminding his interviewers or his listeners that America was and had always been an ultimate intent for Islamization, and also reiterated or reinforced their right to essentially kill Christians and Jews. That's a lot. In a week, we're getting much less of that. Why is
that? It's a big deal. ISIS, or the Islamic State, is one of the new phenomena coming out of the Middle East. We're accustomed to decades and decades of conflict of one kind or another in the Middle East, but there are some new features in the current constellation of events over there, and this is one of them. Although, as Ecclesiastes teaches us, there's nothing new under the sun, and in a sense, the core characteristics of the Islamic State do go back centuries and centuries and centuries to the very era of the founder of Islam, Muhammad himself. For the characteristics of the Islamic State are essentially three in nature. One is it is entirely founded on the idea of making real God's rule on earth through the descendants of the prophet, the messenger, so that it is a state that is made up of no notion of political allegiance, no notion of cultural or ethnic allegiance. All cultures, all ethnicities, all political stripes are within its self-understood purview. The second striking feature of it is it's a state with no particular territorial claim. That is to say, it views itself as legitimately able to rule any territory over which it can establish itself. So that if the Islamic State begins in some corner of Syria or Iraq or Kurdistan or Turkey, it sees itself as legitimately entitled to spread theoretically to every single corner of the globe, including the Americas. And the third crucial feature of it that marks it as new and different from anything we've seen at any time recently in the Middle East is that it views as its opposition every other competing claim to sovereign authority. That is to say, its own self-declared enemies are not just people who don't happen to be but belong to its brand of Sunni Islam, that is, the Shiites, the Christians, the Yazidis, whom they have already been beheading, children and others as they encounter them, Jews in the Middle East or elsewhere if they could find them. But their enemies are every other body that lays claim to any sort of state authority. So. If one knows, if one defines one's enemies as one's friends as the enemies of one's enemy, this is truly creating a strange bedfellowship. For the enemies of the Islamic State include not just the State of Israel, the obvious target for Muslim fanatics in that part of the world, but the government of Bashar Assad, the current government, whatever it is, of Iraq, the government of Lebanon, the opposition in Syria, the government of Kurdistan, the government of Turkey, the government of Saudi Arabia, any government that puts itself up in opposition to the Islamic State or that refuses or indicates that will refuse to yield to the authority of the head of the Islamic State, who doesn't call himself a president, a prime minister, a king or an emir, but calls himself instead the caliph, meaning the successor to the role of the prophet. This is decidedly a theocratic state intended to realize on earth the dream of a single caliphate, a single state driven by its purest understanding of the intention of the founder, Muhammad.
What an excellent summary. What an excellent overview.
There you go, Yael.
Indeed, that reminds me that for years, you and your partner taught in London, usually, an annual
Oxford,
seminar
actually.
For lawyers on essentially Islamic law.
That's right. I'm probably one of the few Jewish practitioners of Sharia you'll ever meet. But there it is. I have had a fairly substantial practice in Islamic law in the areas of Islamic finance, marital settlements, and estate settlements. But that necessitates – actually is born out of a deep interest in Islam because of its political importance globally for the United States, a decision that I made when I was an undergraduate where you used to teach at the University of Chicago, deciding that the future of my civilization, that is the West, and the future of my republic, that is the United States, would unavoidably come into contact with this ancient, great, and powerful Islamic civilization.
The very point at which one might remind listeners that a very, very important book by a very important political scientist, I mean deservedly important, some years ago, the book being The Clash of Civilizations, said there are two great clashes to come between the West and China, but probably before that, and equally challenging, between the West and Islam,
or what he calls Huntington and we're there.
What he calls Christendom and Islam.
You're referring to Samuel Huntington.
Sam Huntington.
And we are there.
We are there. And a week ago, it looked as if they had gathered tremendous force, this ISIS bunch, and might really pose a serious challenge. Now, has that challenge been somehow reduced or contained? Chris?
Oh, I think that the challenge is extraordinary. It is as unusual, to put it into Joe's terms, as the emergence of this new element in the constellation of actors in the Middle East. And I also think that it is progressing. I think we have been distracted this week. The news flow in the United States has taken us into the direction of this decision by the administration to try to intervene on some sort of humanitarian basis and on a protective basis relative to Americans in Erbil in northern Iraq. And that has drawn attention away from other ISIS or ISIL, and I prefer ISIL, activities, not just in the south of Iraq, where as recently as a few days ago they were attacking towns south of Baghdad, which puts them with a great sweep over what we have called Iraq. But in addition to that, just yesterday I found out through British newspapers that they took two more towns in eastern Syria. So while we are looking at what they are doing towards Erbil, or while we are looking at what they are doing towards the Yazidis, they are so large, they have so much freedom of movement that they're moving south in Iraq and further into Syria.
Now, what are the numbers? What sort of army have they mounted? And not only numbers, but quality estimates as well. Okay, what sort of materiel are they in possession of?
The number that is thrown around just at the popular level is sort of 10,000.
That's not much.
That's not much. I mean, you think of a division, okay? A division would be on the order of 14, 15,000. Mm-hmm. So they're not really – there are a couple of brigades right now. They're not really at division level, let alone corps level, let alone army level. But that is 10,000. And I think the question of materiel is that they on the one hand, possess a lot of military hardware already, and that comes from a variety of sources, the black market. They also have a lot of American materiel that they've taken from Iraqis who have left their posts, and they're having issues with that. But they, in addition to the materiel, they now have, because of banks that they have taken over in their sweep of eastern Syria and northwest
particularly
Iran,
the bank at Mosul, I believe.
In Mosul, they're estimated to control some $400-500 million. This all makes them – so they're profoundly unusual given our 70, 80 100-year terms of reference for the Middle East, as Joe says. And in addition to that, what I hope to add to this conversation is they're particularly potent, and that gives them capabilities that even al-Qaeda on the day Barack Obama took office, or the day George Bush took office, didn't have.
Is it the case that many, in hundreds, maybe in thousands, are now flocking to their banner and picking up weapons in service of them? Chechen fighters have been flooding in and joining their ranks. And, of course, from all over the Middle East, there are many. And we read even that there are some Americans and English, possibly of or usually of Islamic background, but native English, Native Americans, who've got over there as well.
The Caliph has put out a call to I'm calling him the Caliph as he is.
What's his name?
I'm sorry. Do you have it, Chris?
No, I don't.
I'm sorry. I don't recall it. I've been calling him the Caliph for the last month or so since he proclaimed himself the Caliph. There's no known body or academy or group of Islamic scholars with authority to designate him the Caliph. He's absorbed the title for himself.
His name is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi.
There's the man.
Thank you. Al-Baghdadi.
Baghdadi.
Means he comes from Baghdad. It
implies he comes from Baghdad. Yes, that's right.
It should be noted, the name matter, Abu Bakr is very important figure in early Islam, I think, essentially.
Name of one of the early followers
of Muhammad, exactly.
Right. Abu Bakr, meaning literally the father of Bakr. The father of Bakr, who comes from Baghdad, is what his name means. The Caliph put out a call early on for all righteous Muslims to join the fight and come from anywhere. Ethnicity, language don't matter. And hundreds, if not thousands, have answered that call from outside Syria and Iraq, getting there how? Many of them coming across Lebanon. But strikingly, many of them coming across the porous borders of Turkey. Now, Turkey is a wild card in all of this, and certainly another big picture feature that needs to concern the United States as we think strategically about this region for the long haul is the role of Turkey in it. For Turkey's behaviors have in some respects been troublesome for a good while.
Turkey, which aspired to be part of NATO.
Turkey is part of NATO. Turkey has aspired to be part of the European Union.
Yeah.
Although, and having been rebuffed rather impolitely by the Europeans, Turkey may now be rethinking its desire to integrate itself politically and economically into.
And Erdogan, or however you say his name, has just been reelected.
The longtime, decade-long prime minister of Turkey, his name pronounced Erdogan.
Erdogan.
G is sort of a W sound. Has just been elected president in a context in which Turkey is undergoing some constitutional transformations that move in at least two directions. One is a greater centralization of power in the presidency as opposed to in the cabinet and prime minister, which report to the parliament, but more accretion of authority in the executive. And the second constitutional transformation, and this is a radical departure from the traditions of the Turkish Republic as established after World War I under the leadership of the founder of the modern republic, known to the West as Atatürk. And that is a strong tilt toward an Islamic component in the ideology and the juridical system undergirding the state. Modern Turkey, in the wake of Atatürk, has been a fiercely secular republic, with the political activities of the mosque, so to speak, repressed.
And the military, as I understand it,
military
over recent years, strongly opposed to anything that tends towards theocracy.
The military has long been the guardian of the constconstitution of Turkey, including its secularist.
Rather reminds you of the Egyptian military at the moment, having gotten rid of the Brotherhood.
And this is something that Prime Minister, soon to be President Erdogan, has been working assiduously to change over the course of the last decade. There are lots of things in flux. Certainly, Turkey historically has been very nervous about the possible disintegration of Iraq because of the potential rise of an independent Kurdistan. The Kurds are another population for whom the line-drawing exercises that followed World War I mean nothing politically. The ethnic Kurd is Kurdish areas spill over into a number of political districts, so to speak, within the Middle East, including notably Iraq and neighboring parts of Turkey. And the idea of the creation of an independent Kurdistan with irredentist ambitions toward that part of Kurdistan that's within the political definition of the modern nation state of Turkey has historically been very worrisome to Ankara. The Erdogan regime recently has been a lot less exercised about that. It seems to have made its peace, at least in part, with Kurdish interests. And no small amount of that, of course, has been the responsibility that has been shown by Iraqi Kurdistan and the tremendous success that they have in building a civil society and civil administration and an economy in their territory within Iraq. But that's part and parcel of the strategic problems we have with the development of a new post-war Iraq.
Chris Roebling.
Well, and so at the level of battles, okay, and this inevitably leads to the ambiguous position of the United States government in all of this. But if you're looking for people to counter ISIL, there are Kurdish ethnic forces in Syria who normally would hook
up. As well as in Iraq.
But what I'm saying is those in Iraq and those from Turkey, the PKK from Turkey, this group that Joe was just referring to, has an enormous amount of experience in these kinds of battles. And currently the West, which considers PKK to be a terrorist organization, right? The U.S., the U.K., the EU, all find the People's Kurdistan Army to be a terrorist organization.
About which only one kind thing can be said, its opposition to Bashar Assad.
And unfortunately, that designation is now inhibiting enlisting PKK into a fight on a enemy of our enemy is our friend basis against ISIL. So there, I don't think that the regular or the average American has time to really get into all of the levels of either ethnic or religious complexity.
A scorecard in this conflict will require a phone book.
But that gets us to the United. So what kind of leadership, therefore, is being exercised by the United States? And you know, you talk about a week ago, Milton, there was all of this talk at that moment about we're going to have these bombing runs. We're going to have these air strikes. We're going to go after specific targets. We're going to prevent ISIL from getting to Erbil, where we've got 300 Americans in the consulate, kind of a post-Benghazi concern for consulate security. And we're going to help the Yazidis get off the mountain, so to speak. And at that moment, the president is quoted by Tom Friedman, and you can see him yourself on the New York Times website, saying, and we'll push ISIL back. We're going to push them back. And he doesn't say what you would have heard from prior presidents, Bill Clinton or George Bush before him, which would be, and we will eliminate ISIL. Okay? So there's a sense of there. I think that internationally, with this very microscopic choice for microscopic military involvement by the United States, this rhetoric by the president, there's sort of a perception in the global community, the United States has reconciled itself to a future Mideast that includes the caliphate.
I want to raise a very significant question concerning the ultimate nature of religious political movements. And even though they are, as in Joe's wonderful summary, they don't see politics as separate from religion and see it as subordinate always to religion. But let's talk about the question of whether this caliphate movement now run by ISIS or ISIL, whether it is a reductio ad extremis or merely a reductio ad absurdum of Islam itself. Is this inherent in Islam, and is that the way to explain the fact that lots of so-called moderate Muslims aren't protesting very much, even when these guys begin beheading their way towards Baghdad and so on? Are we seeing the true essence of Islam in a kind of nativist revival, which will have long-run consequences for the world?
If your question is this an authentic expression of Islam, the answer necessarily is yes. History tells us that. We've seen this before in over centuries. We've seen Islamic movements crystallize into political and military movements that advance across great swaths of territory.
Will it ultimately take over the Islamic world? That's
There's historic precedent for that too, and on more than one occasion, as Islamic movements have swept back and forth across this part of the world, beginning with Muhammad and following through at least three major what we call in Western parlance dynasties of rulerships in that part of the world. Subsequent to that, most recently, ending I suppose in this part of the world with the Ottoman Turkish Empire, which kind of consolidated rule of at least the Eastern, the Asian, and some African parts of the Muslim world under an Ottoman Turkic caliph based in what is modern Istanbul. So it's happened before,
but that was without. I mean, there were folks in the Ottoman Empire. I mean, you can go to the 18th century and you can find that there were various. Even officials of the who were not Muslim, part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire's success depended on not forcibly transforming local peoples into Muslims.
At times in its history, the Ottoman Empire was. Stunningly
diverse, to use today's term.
Diverse and tolerant.
Yeah.
For example, after the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492, thousands and thousands and thousands of them were welcomed, to be sure as second-class citizens, but welcomed nonetheless into what was then the Ottoman Empire. And there's a whole history there. I once took a boat from Istanbul on the Bosporus to a port on a Black Sea, a commuter vessel. To keep an appointment. And as I was riding on the boat, I hear a couple of men sitting in front of me speaking Spanish. It sounded to me all the world like Spanish. I intervened in their conversation to find out what were these two Spanish speakers doing riding a commuter boat from Istanbul to some nearby suburban port.
My guess is they were Marranos.
They were Ladinos. They were descendants of Jews from Spain who had landed in Turkey, sure. Some 500 years before, and had preserved that language,
the Sephardim of the Iberian Peninsula, who then are shipped essentially into the Ottoman Empire.
So I repeat, if your question is this an authentic expression of Islam? The answer is yes, and it's one with precedence. The other side is this the exclusive, the only legitimate expression of Islam? And the answer to that also has to be no. Because there are a number of other authentic and historically based and successful expressions of Islam, some of which are very, very different in their political and militaristic
expression. But does it grab the hearts of young Muslims now?
It grabs the hearts of young Muslims who have no hope. We're dealing with an accumulated deficit of opportunity, of hope, of participation, of prosperity, of freedom. Of an ability to provide for oneself. To this day, after all of the turmoil in Egypt over the last 5 years, to this day, young men in Egypt have such a hard time finding a job. They cannot basically imagine saving enough money to perform the social tasks that are requisite to taking a wife and having a home and a family.
Chris, may I try to restate your point this way? See if I'm making your point, which is that there is a recent history, decades long, of corruption and incompetence among rulers of Muslim states all across the region that has left their economies and their cultures in shambles, family life in shambles. The siren song of a caliph who holds out the promise of sweeping away this corruption as the antidote to the Muslim disease, the Islamic world being a sick man from coast to coast, from border to border of the entire region, unable to progress, unable to give people hope, unable to give people economic success. Here, the caliph is offering a purest vision of Islam. As the antidote to this sad recent history,
the West and the United States consciously chose stability over democracy for a 70-year period, and folks knew there would come a transformation. And in these two administrations, we see two different ways of approaching the transformation. George Bush, rightly, wrongly, goodly, badly, whatever, for lack of a better term, just for quick conversation, took a sort of a neocon approach of purposefully and purposively spreading democracy. Barack Obama, rightly, wrongly, goodly, badly, has taken what I would consider to be a sort of a self-critical position of withdrawal. And so whether it's the Muslims in Tehran early in his first term crying out for relief from the Ayatollahs and their attempt at a Shia caliphate based up there, or if it is the victims of the so-called Arab Spring, Barack Obama has been hands off, leading from behind, indecisive, uncertain, and withdrawn.
Coming down to a mere American recent history and political debate as it rages or as it simmers right now. Is it not the case, I ask of two gentlemen, both of whom have had some identification with the Republican Party, that there's a great deal of feeling now that George W. made a very basic mistake by carrying us into the Iraq invasion? And that it has had very bad consequences, the consequences that we're discussing right now.
That's a widespread feeling that certainly it has had political consequences. I mean, it explains in no small measure the rise and indeed the election and re-election of Barack Obama. But it also has influenced the opinions of elites both inside and outside the Republican Party, inside and outside the United States. The Nobel Prize undoubtedly was given to Barack Obama in 2009 for the simple proposition that he was a president of the United States who was not George W. Bush. But there was a certain intellectual honesty about Bush number 43, George W. Bush, where this vision of his, for good or for ill, was laid out clearly and fairly unambiguously. For example, in his 2005, his second inaugural address, there it is, this vision of the role of America in spreading democracy throughout the world, including in the Middle East. A wise
rather
vision.
Like the Wilsonian vision of no. Quote making the world safe for democracy.
No, it was a pretty substantial refinement on the Wilsonian. It wasn't a mere extrapolation of the Wilsonian vision 100 years later, but it laid out a vision. It laid out a vision and actions backed up that vision, and so there's a record that can be parsed and analyzed and criticized, justifiably so. With Mr. Obama, it's much harder. There is inaction more often than there is action, and there is a precious small body of explanation for his vision, his views, his worldview, his theory, his strategies, his goals.
Well, I think you can see Obama, to come down to particulars of American present politics, two ways. Either he is feckless and avoidant and stoical and or apathetic, or else he's very wisely forbearing and effectively pragmatic, and thus making decisions as he goes. Sufficient unto the day is the crisis thereof.
Well, I personally am going to lean in the first direction, and I'm going to say that I think he's feckless, but he's got a lot of. A lot of noxious influences are unfortunately coloring his version of fecklessness. I want to go back to your question about Iraq. I think it's as Joe points out, it's undoubtedly the case that Bush is wearing a political jacket for Iraq, which that's appropriate because it was his call. The popular perception is it was a big mistake. I think the actual record over time is going to yield a much different view. I think that over the Barack Obama's administration and his supporters in the media have consistently, just endlessly, taken the position that all that Bush did there was wrong and there is nothing redeeming about it. I think in time, historians will sit down and they will see the transformation that took place in Iraq over a pretty short period of time, and they will see an almost fully functioning democracy that was handed over to the Obama administration in January of 2009. And I think the truth is the Obama administration will be seen as not having taken yes for an answer. I think that whether it's the status of forces agreement, whether it is supporting civil society, whether it is maintaining connections with individuals and institutions, I just think they backed out of Iraq because of the story they had drawn about Bush.
It is worth noting that just this very day, or was it last night in Iraqi time, the government did change. The prime minister has finally given up.
Well, that's a factor on the ground that may make it make a big difference. It may make it much easier to build coalitions to accomplish things, including not only to suppress the kind of Sunni Shia Kurdish communitarian conflicts we've seen in Iraq in the last few years, but also to build a coalition of Iraqis willing to fight ISIS. In order to preserve some kind of Iraqi polity.
But that also becomes Shia against Sunni, doesn't it?
Well, not necessarily.
Yes, but not necessarily. That is to say, ISIS is certainly Sunni in its orientation.
Yeah.
Right, which could lead to its downfall, because certainly Tehran does not want that to succeed.
But ISIS also has Sunni enemies.
Yeah, exactly. And even Sunni patrons who probably don't want to see it succeed, such as the Saudis and others. But I want to make this point. Two points about Iraq's internal domestic political situation. First is they now seem, I'm not an expert in the field, but they seem to be trying sort of a Lebanese approach. So they're going to take people from different areas and make sure institutionally that they are from different segments of society and disperse power in the government between representatives of those segments. Now, what we do with structural federalism or actual federalism, we've got a lot of checks and balances here, sitting with a constitutional lawyer who knows this stuff better than I do. But they're trying to do some of that with the reality of the ethnic and sectarian differences. May work, may not. But that gets me to my second point. The second point is, this the incumbency of Nouri al-Maliki has been a very well-worn crutch for Barack Obama and this administration relative to difficulties rebuilding coalitions, as Joe said, getting anything done. So they have had that, and they have said when Maliki is gone, then we will be able to. Now they have it. And I think, again, the eyes of the world are going to be on the United States to see, okay, you've gotten your way with the domestic political arrangement in Iraq. What is the United States actually going to do?
No boots on the ground ever.
The most trenchant.
What about that assertion by the president and his cabal?
Well, it's naive and dangerous thing to assert.
Self-limiting.
It invites challenge. Well, if the great power is telling us that there will never be boots on the ground, then there are all kinds of restraints that otherwise might limit what we want to do that are gone, that are off. So that invites the test, that invites the challenge. If the United States says no matter what happens, we will not intervene. No matter what happens, we will not act. No matter what happens, there will not be boots on the ground. It creates a vacuum and invites someone to fill it. Perhaps the most trenchant criticism of this approach on the part of Mr. Obama to world politics, perhaps the single most important job that any president has, is that given in the last week or so by Hillary Clinton, who said great nations need organizing principles. And don't do stupid stuff, attributing the line don't do stupid stuff to Mr. Obama, is not an organizing principle.
I think that the Hillary Clinton storyline of the last 8 days, since you've been focusing on this week, you know, we've had this extraordinary sequence of events in which the president spoke, I would say, with stunning clarity to Tom Friedman of The New York Times. And at about the same time, a Hillary Clinton interview was being released in The Atlantic magazine. And so you had these two principal actors in American foreign policy over the last 6 years speaking out very clearly and very directly. And I think that shows a fissure on the Democratic side. Obviously, Hillary Clinton is watching the polls, seeing the president's unpopularity on foreign policy increase, knowing her own link to that foreign policy, is seeking to distance herself from him and from it, as Joe points out. And I think that bespeaks a weakness on the Democrats, on the president's own political base about how he should proceed.
We have looked at a very complex and a very important situation, which will be changing perhaps almost day by day, and we'll have to talk about it again on other forthcoming podcasts. I would not be doing my duty if I did not direct your attention only for the next 10 or 15 minutes to somewhat to the northwest, but not very far to the northwest, and to the Israel-Gaza conflict.
May I stop you there?
And the dealings in Egypt at the moment. But you've got something you want to add.
I just want to say we've been talking for nearly an hour.
Yeah.
And you're about to make a very awkward segue to talk about Israel. Notice how, except accidentally, around the margins, and I mentioned it very early on, nearly an hour ago, Israel hasn't come up in this conversation at all. We're talking about major events, civilizational clashes, major issues in the Middle East that have nothing to do with Israel. The existence of Israel, the non-existence of Israel, policies regarding Israel have driven none of what we've been talking about for the last hour, which I think gives the lie to a canard that surfaces over and over and over again in Western policymaking, including in the mind, I think, of Barack Obama, that somehow a solution, this ever, never to be found, always fleeting, chimerical, gossamer solution to the Israel-Palestine conflict, quote unquote, is the solution, is the key to achieving peace in the Middle East. That's bunkum. That's nuts.
And that carried John Kerry into the first year of his secretaryship.
Well, this,
that
this
became his major preoccupation.
Absolutely, and this is a very hard lesson to learn. That the Israeli Arab conflict is a tail on a very, very big dog.
Yeah, if I may, here is another way of saying, not to say that I'm restating, but the opposition to Israel has taken on, for in my opinion, decades, the status of boogeyman creation by the Arab states. That both did not want to deal with the refugee crisis. The refugees were absolutely human. Just as far as they were concerned, they were, extra problem to ignore. But they also were desperate to keep domestic attention off of their own failures. So what Joe was talking about 20 minutes ago, relative to the absolute fruit of the incompetence of the leaders in many of these Middle Eastern states, you know, that's always harder if you have to take responsibility for what's going on. And they would put out the lie that the real problem is not what's going on domestically, it's Israel and the Jewish state. And as soon as we can get rid of the Jewish state, then things, you know, milk and honey will result. I agree with Joe that what we have seen here in this is that the opposition to Israel is simply a subsidiary of these regimes that cannot bear internal, domestic, free, independent political scrutiny.
Still, from the point of view of those looking on from Tel Aviv or from Jerusalem or from Haifa or for those looking on from the congregation that Joe is an important member of here in Chicago, it is a compelling question as to whether Israel can finally get some stability in its relations with the Palestinians. Is there any possible promise in the Cairo negotiations, if that's what they are, that maybe this can be resolved, that maybe, in fact, Hamas can be, quote, tamed?
I will offer three, I think, big picture observations coming out of the last month's developments involving the conflict between Israel and Hamas over Gaza. Number one is, and this is vitally important, we've known for a long time that to have a quote-unquote two-state solution requires two states. That means the Israelis have to have somebody serious out there with whom to negotiate and do business. And it's been conspicuous that neither in the West Bank part of the Palestinian area, that is that part controlled by the PLO pretty much, or the Gaza part, that part controlled by Hamas, has there been a really successful effort at embryonic nation building, building set aside the question of building anything approaching a real democracy, but approaching civil society, civil administration, success and competence in civil administration. And that's been even more conspicuous in Gaza and the Hamas-controlled territory than it's been in the PA, in the West Bank area. What we have learned the hard way in the last month by the discovery of this vast network of underground tunnels being built with enormous labor and at huge expense by Hamas.
From the international community, including the U.S.
Underground Gaza, underneath Gaza, as an offensive weapon to be used to rain terror and death on innocent Israeli civilians, paid for with those huge shipments of so-called humanitarian supplies, construction materials, concrete, bags and bags and bags of cement, wood, timber, iron, steel brought in supposedly to help build a civil society in Gaza, and instead buried underground in this vast network of offensive military tunnels. So issue one, what is revealed here is that there's an enormous amount of work to be done on the part of Palestinian Arabs in building a real civil society and civil administration. Amazing development number two is, and I think we said earlier in the conversation, the single most important military political relationship the Israelis have at the moment is not that with the United States, it is that with Egypt. And it is Egypt that is leading the negotiations. It is Egypt that is making a common cause, ironically, at the same time with Israel in mounting its own defense against Hamas-based, Gaza-based terrorism. But what is striking is that this new working alliance that's just kind of coming into vision, into image, into clarity, extends far beyond Egypt to other Arab countries, including, for example, Saudi Arabia, which has been showing a quiet subterranean willingness to cooperate with Israel in dealing with the Hamas problem in this same stretch.
So while still funding,
of course,
Wahhabi-based schools, and they're still creating new.
There's the right hand doing one thing and the left hand
exactly.
doing mischief, of course. And exactly. there's a certain schizophrenia, so to speak. Sorry to borrow that term, probably abuse that term from your profession, but a multivalent. Positions yeah. of many of these regimes around the region that is a long-term problem of its own. The third big development, development number one is there's no there when it comes to civil society and among Palestinian Arabs. They have to develop one to make a two-state solution work, right? Number two is the growth of this separate set of relations that Israel has with Arab states, longtime frontline conflicting Arab states like Egypt and Saudi Arabia, that in some respect, in a practical way, is displacing the role of the United States as the key interlocutor in the region.
And the third is?
And the third is something that I think we have seen. It's technological, something we have seen here that will have vast implications for our own strategic thinking and for decades to come. It is Iron Dome. Mm-hmm. Iron Dome, the anti-rocket technology that the Israelis have developed with American support, that has shown a stunning close to 90% success rate in knocking Hamas-fired missiles out of the air before they hit Israeli population centers, most of the time with mere seconds of notice. Yet they're able to fire.
I can't resist remembering they laughed at Ronald Reagan when he laid out Star Wars.
And
they still do.
This is the direct strategic moral brainchild of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was committed to the idea. He was a fierce foe, much fiercer than Mr. Obama is, of nuclear weapons. He was morally offended by the idea that civilian populations would be held hostage by nuclear weapons to the vagaries of global politics by politicians. And realizing how difficult it is to pry weapons out of the hands of politicians, he thought that the solution was to build defense.
I should tell you, and I should tell our listeners, we've got an interview in the can with Ken Edelman, who was with Reagan at
Reykjavik.
And we haven't yet.
It's a great book.
We had lunch with him.
I know he was in town. Yeah. I couldn't get over that day. But they haven't yet put. We have not yet put that interview up.
This is a great
website,
time to do it. It's a great
will.
Time
well,
to
Iron
do
Dome,
it.
Iron Dome is the direct descendant of that Reagan vision,
sure.
and it's in a straight line. And the technology is being seen here to work, and it has a real political impact in Israel.
If I can say, Iron Dome is what Gorbachev feared. It didn't exist then. Okay, the SDI, the Strategic Defense Initiative, which was derisively named by the liberal media Star Wars. Okay, was at Reykjavik in 1986 on that weekend, that fateful weekend, was neither as powerful as Reagan thought it was, nor was it as fearsome as Gorbachev thought it was. But that didn't matter because it occupied this mental space for both of them, and it became a fulcrum over which the events of that weekend played out. So that's a great story.
And here
I look
we are 30 years
it.
On, and we've but, seen yeah. in this little laboratory
right. it's
a,
doing
a
great.
Tendril of SDI called Iron Dome, and it works.
But I want to join Joe in saying if you are taking any sort of historic view of these epochal changes that are going on in the Middle East, the retreat of the United States from any sort of significant role in assisting the advent of a modicum of peace or at least a ceasefire, and the assumption of that role by Egypt is absolutely fascinating, and it is descriptive, it is illustrative, it demonstrates the U.S. retreat, and it is of a, I would say, of a kind with what happened 13 months ago when we came within an afternoon of bombing Syria and then retreated and essentially a week later handed over the Syrian
question. Was the retreat politically realistic in response to the needs, the war weariness, one might say, of the American public?
Oh, I think the retreat on Syria?
Our retreat.
I think that it is a failure because it failed. Whatever the war weariness factor is, it's got to be taken into account by office holders and presidents and secretaries of state, et cetera, et cetera. You can't go to war if everybody and nobody wants to go to war in the first place. But number two, that's the easy part. The easy part, the difficult or the challenging or the demanding and the important part is to advance the interests of the United States. If you have to be a little bit on the sidelines because of Afghanistan, because of Iraq, and not to concede the point, but for conversation, then you have to find another way to advance strategic American interests, which are also the interests of our allies and the interests of peace and democracy and prosperity around the entire world.
I introduced last week's podcast with a quotation from one poet, William Wordsworth. I draw this one to a close with another poetic quotation, this one from Yeats's The Widening Gyre. The worst are full of passionate intensity. The best lack all conviction. The center will not hold. Is that descriptive of the world as it is and us in the world, or is it off? The worst are full of passionate intensity, clearly.
Him to be born.
That's what happens later in that poem, yes. Right. A new beast. Slouching towards Bethlehem
to be born. I hope not. There is a wonderful beast, a kind and tolerant beast, a beast of burden for democracy in the world, the American Republic. I hope it is revivified and reinvigorated.
I might as well quote Reagan. We're only a generation away from losing liberty at any moment.
Gentlemen, I am really profoundly in your debt. This has been a superb conversation by two men I have always much admired, and you've given evidence of the basis for that admiration today. Thank you truly ever so much.